supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. We are 2 weeks out from the annual NBA draft, and the 76ers have six picks, including the number 10 selection overall. In the interim, they'll be assessing potential rookies without insight from Brian Colangelo, two-time NBA Executive of the Year, who today announced his resignation as 76ers General Manager. Let's wend our way through the process with Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with a quick recap of the events that over the past 9 days led to today's action?
About 9 days ago, Ringer.com, a website that is notoriously pro-Sam Hinkie, the former and deposed general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers, ran a story citing an anonymous source who was anonymous to them, who had curated these links between five different Twitter accounts, four of which were critical of the Sixers players, and very good to Brian Colangelo. So the writer looked at the accounts, took a couple of them to the Sixers and said, "What do you know about this?" Brian Colangelo, the general manager, said, "One of them is mine," and it was an account that had never tweeted, but denied any sort of knowledge about the other account that was brought to him. The other three accounts suddenly went dark, and the Sixers launched an investigation. The results of that investigation were that the four other accounts were being run by Barbara Pittini, Brian Colangelo's wife, either with or without his knowledge. The law firm that conducted the investigation, Paul and Weiss, issued a statement today that said that, quote, "We cannot conclude that Mr. Colangelo was aware of the Twitter accounts prior to the press inquiry that was made by the writer, and that he denies awareness. However, they did note that their investigation was limited and impeded by actions taken by Ms. Pittini, including her decision to delete the contents of her iPhone by executing a factory reset of the device prior to surrendering it for forensic review." That might have been the axe that chopped his head off right there.
Marcus, across basketball and across sports, how prolific is the practice for players, managers, and GMs to have several Twitter accounts like this?
Well, in Brian Colangelo's defense, I believe he had one Twitter account that he took responsibility for, and that's the one that was dormant. I think it's very common, and so does Brian Colangelo, he said so in a statement, for players and coaches and general managers and reporters to have Twitter accounts that can't be necessarily easily traced to them. If you want to tweet something political, or if you want to follow somebody you might be ashamed of being ashamed of people knowing or following, you set up a burner account and you do it that way. Most of the negative tweets I get are from anonymous accounts, burner accounts, accounts that don't have any sort of traceable affiliation. It's the sort of, you know, cowardly social media world we live in today. And a lot of the players use these accounts to monitor what's being said about them, and sometimes to get back.
And so in the interim, the 76ers have named Brett Brown to that task.
Brett has essentially been the general manager of this team for the last 5 years. He's been the face and the voice of the team. He's handled all of the controversies. He's been involved in most of the personnel decisions. He's a really remarkable guy for a guy who's never been a head coach before. He came to being a head coach relatively late in life. He's perfect for the job.
Sixers fans and many throughout the NBA have been holding their breath for the past 9 days. But in the scheme of things, does this at all retard the progress of the process?
You know, Dave, it might accelerate the process. The biggest issue the Sixers faced in the offseason was that at the end of the year press conference, Brett Brown expressed his desire to pursue a top free agent like LeBron James or Paul George, or acquire a player from the like Kawhi Leonard from the Spurs. Whereas Brian Colangelo said, "Well, maybe we'll wait a year on that." And that, to me, was a pretty big rift. That was a pretty big division. So I believe that the Sixers will be more aggressive sooner in getting the final piece or pieces they need to make a run past just the playoffs and a third seed and a win, but toward a championship.
Marcus, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Philadelphia Daily News and Inquirer columnist Marcus Hayes on NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia can thank immigrants for reversing decades of population decline. That's according to new research from the Pew Charitable Trust's Philadelphia Research Initiative. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has more on who's coming to our region and how Philadelphia stacks up against other major American cities when it comes to immigration.
Philadelphia wasn't always a big destination for immigrants.
The nation as a whole, the country as a whole, started seeing big increases in immigration starting around in the 70s.
That's report author Tom Ginsberg.
And Philly was not a part of that. It was tagged kind of a low immigration metro area.
He says in the 90s, that started to change. Fast forward to 2016, the most recent year census data are available, and about a quarter of Philadelphia residents are first or second generation immigrants. Nearly 400,000 people. Ginsberg says starting that same year, Philadelphia hit the highest number of immigrants it's had in any time since 1950. But that growth just puts it among the ranks of other big U.S. metro areas in terms of attracting immigrants.
In a sense, it's now catching up with other big cities instead of falling behind them.
The single largest group of Philadelphia residents born in another country are from China. Researchers also found that people moving to Philadelphia come from a notably wide range of countries. The fastest growing group are African immigrants. Eric Eddy, the chief operating officer of AFRICOM, a local social service group, says that's a good thing.
Well, as an African immigrant myself, I would say that yes, it is. In terms of vibrancy, in terms of visibility in the socio-economic fabric, of Philadelphia, I have seen that coming. So it's a good thing.
He says while places like Washington, D.C. and New York City still have much larger African immigrant populations, he's glad Philly is on more immigrants' radars. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Every summer in mid-July, thousands gather outside the walls of Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia for a reenactment of the storming of the French Bastille prison, complete with tasty cakes. After 24 years of historical hijinks, this year will be the last, as WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
Every Bastille Day, about 6,000 people storm the gates of Eastern State Penitentiary, the prison museum in Philadelphia's Fairmount neighborhood. They come to watch a silly skit ending with the beheading of a watermelon in a guillotine and for Marie Antoinette to deliver her famous line.
If the people...
Marie Antoinette is played by Terry McNally, the proprietor of the neighborhood restaurant London Grill. She created the Bastille Day celebration 24 years ago as a way to bump up the summer doldrums of the restaurant business. After partnering with the Eastern State Penitentiary, it really took off, becoming a street festival.
It's large. It's huge. People come from all over. A lot of kids. You know, it's a real, even though it's about beheading, it's a real family, kind of a kids event.
Alas, no more. The Bastille Day celebration will come to an end after this year's performance, the axe brought down by Eastern State Penitentiary itself. Recently, the museum came up with a strategic plan to double down on its goal to be America's premier museum about criminal justice reform. The admittedly goofy Bastille Day celebration, which includes a drag cabaret troupe singing Edith Piaf songs, falls outside that mission. It's also expensive to put on. Museum Vice President Sean Kelly says he can't afford it anymore.
Everything from the stage rental to the sound systems to the street closures, and it is an enormous all-hands-on-deck process for months every year for an event that takes 1 hour and doesn't have any revenue for us. I mean, it's free, so it doesn't make any sense for us to spend that much time.
Eastern State Penitentiary also hosts the hugely popular Terror Behind the Walls Haunted Halloween attraction, another event beyond the pale of the museum's stated mission. But Kelly says that's different because it brings in money, a lot of money. More than half of the museum's annual operating budget comes from Terror Behind the Walls, and without it, the historic prison would likely get the guillotine. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
New Jersey is getting ready to finally cash in on sports betting. The state spent millions of dollars challenging a federal law that basically blocked states other than Nevada from taking bets on sporting events. Now, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, New Jersey will become one of the first states to allow sports gambling after that ban was lifted. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, public officials and gambling houses alike say they just hit the jackpot.
Dennis Drazen went to a racetrack for the first time in 1958. His dad took him. Drazen said it was love at first sight. He got his law degree and later bought a horse of his own in 1980.
Well, the first horse we raced was named Bodacious Tatas.
Today, Drazen runs the Central New Jersey racetrack Monmouth Park, and he's had to find a way to keep the track financially solvent, which can be a difficult job.
It's tough to make any money on racing. So, you know, the racing revenues are probably a loss.
That's why Drazen, as the head of the New Jersey Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, joined the state in suing the major sports leagues in an effort to eliminate the ban on sports betting. Well before the cases were resolved, a confident Drazen partnered with the sports betting company William Hill to build a new facility for sports betting at Monmouth Park. Drazen says the track took a gamble on sports betting and won.
I'm happy with this. We're going to make money. We're going to save racing. The state's going to make money. This is a win-win for everybody.
Drazen and Monmouth Park aren't the only ones hoping to make some money as a result of the Supreme Court's ruling. One group that is sure to cash in on sports betting is the state of New Jersey itself. Rummy Pandit researches gaming and hospitality at Stockton University.
The revenue that was being generated illegally is now going to be generated legally and is going to generate taxes for the state.
The New Jersey treasurer estimates the state will earn about $13 million from sports betting in its first year. Others say that's a conservative calculation. The American Gaming Association estimates that people in the U.S. illegally wager $150 billion on sports annually. Pandit says the legalization of sports betting will also be a boon to Atlantic City, which is hoping to recast its image from the old days as a hub for casino gambling.
There is a whole new market that will be coming to New Jersey now, and they'll be coming not just for sports betting, they'll be coming for the experience. We are entertainment, we are hospitality, we are lodging, we are food and beverage, all of the above, and we have a beach.
New Jersey's long and winding road to legal sports betting began a decade ago. In 2008, former Union City Mayor Rudy Garcia went to place a bet with his bookie and instead walked into an FBI sting. He was arrested and charged. His friend, Ray Lesniak, heard what happened to Garcia and found the whole ordeal unfair.
My indignation was for my friend who was arrested for doing something that he could have done very well done legally in Las Vegas. And what I did when I carried bets from my dad to the local grocery store to place.
Lesniak also happened to be a state senator at the time and decided to challenge the federal ban on sports betting. First, he successfully pushed for an amendment to the New Jersey Constitution. Then, Lesniak and the administration of then-Governor Chris Christie went to court with the four major sports leagues who wanted to keep the federal ban on sports betting in place. That produced a years-long legal battle, which finally ended in May when the Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992. Before the bill was passed, states had a chance to legalize sports betting, but many of them, including New Jersey, didn't take it. Lesniak says the odds were against him, but he came out on top.
All these great legal minds, you know, Lesniak has no idea what he's talking about. There's no way this is going to happen. That's why I feel just a little bit self-satisfaction.
There have been a few setbacks in New Jersey since sports betting became legal a few weeks ago. Delaware became the first state to offer sports gambling after the Supreme Court ruling, even though New Jersey had been preparing for legalization for years. And the four major professional leagues, baseball, basketball, football, and hockey, continue to argue that legalized sports betting could compromise the integrity of their games. They asked New Jersey lawmakers to impose an integrity fee on bets to help fund the league's efforts to combat illegal wagering and fixes, but the legislature refused. The leagues are also asking for a requirement that casinos and racetracks share information about sketchy betting patterns with the leagues. Lesniak says he's confident Governor Phil Murphy will sign the sports betting legislation soon. And when he does, Lesniak says he intends to place the first legal sports bet in the state's history.
And I'm going to bet on a future book for the Giants to, oh, this is going to be in Philadelphia. So pardon me, Eagle fans. I'm not Donald Trump. I'm a Giant fan. For the Giants to win a Super Bowl.
Don't think the odds are too strong on that one. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Newly legalized sports wagering is being touted as an opportunity for states to generate needed revenue. It also represents an additional challenge for those susceptible to getting caught up in gambling addiction. Joining me in conversation is Arnie Wexler, a compulsive gambling counselor and former executive director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey. Arnie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for letting me come on and talk about this subject.
Well, let's note from the start that this is not just your profession, it's personal as well, going back some 50 years.
My last bet was April 10th, 1968. I was 30 years old. I started gambling at age 7, and from 7 to 30, it was a disaster. At 14, I was making 50 cents an hour. It was in the early 60s. I went to the racetrack. I won $54, and it changed my life. I thought I was going to be a millionaire from gambling, how easy it was to make money, I thought.
And was that ultimately the allure, easy money?
Absolutely. You know, and then I started to steal to support my gambling, do illegal acts, do things in the stock market that I would have been in jail, but they didn't have computers in those days. So I did anything and everything to support my gambling addiction. Nothing came before my gambling addiction, including my wife and family and job.
Casinos came to New Jersey 40 years ago. Does that example offer a cautionary tale of what might come next with sports betting?
Sure. In 1977, before casinos, there were 14 meetings of Gamblers Anonymous in New Jersey. And 3 years later, there were 47 meetings. If that don't tell you something, I don't know what does. And the other example is this. When I was the executive director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling in New Jersey, we hired Gallup to do a survey. And two of the questions that we asked were, have you ever played illegal numbers? 31% of the respondents said they did. Do you play state lottery? 81% said they did. And the truth is, there are a lot of people that would never do anything illegal and gamble on a sporting event. And now that it's going to be legal, they're going to feel comfortable enough to do it. You're going to see a lot of people get addicted to gambling.
A few years back, you were co-author along with your wife and sports reporter Steve Jacobson of a book entitled All Bets Are Off, Losers, Liars, and Recovery from Gambling Addiction. What did you mean by losers and liars?
Well, you know, most gamblers will come home and tell their family member, wow, I won a lot of money at the track, or I won money in the casino. But this is such a hidden, invisible disease. There's no track marks, there's no dilated pupils, there's no smell, and people can hide it pretty well. I remember a classic call I got. Lady calls me up and she says, my husband and I are married 30 years. I never knew he gambled. He worked for an insurance company. He embezzled $600,000 and he's on the way to jail. And I had no clue that he ever gambled in the 30 years we were married. It's that hidden and invisible.
So in turn, is being honest with oneself and others a first key in recovery?
Well, yes, absolutely. But the fact is that gamblers, even when they hit bottom, they're still looking for a deeper bottom. You know, it's all your money and then relatives and friends and companies and embezzlements and white-collar crime and anything that they can do to get money. Because the belief of a gambler, a compulsive gambler, is the next bet is going to get me out of this hole and make me okay. And I dreamt like that for about 10 years or more.
What ultimately got you to break the habit and stay sober now for more than half a century?
Well, the interesting part is this. You know, the compulsive gambler thinks that they're going to get bailed out, so they don't really need to get help. And one day I was in trouble, and it was getting deeper and deeper. I had 3 years' annual salary. And a guy came to work in my place, and I knew he was a millionaire. So I befriended him and thought he was going to give me the money and pay off my gambling debts and bail me out. And when I talked to him, he told me to go to a 12-step program in New York that helps compulsive gamblers. And I was resistant to do that until he said the magic words that they help you straighten out money problems. So I thought that meant they were going to pay off my gambling debts, and that's the only reason why I went there. And 8 weeks after I got there, I gambled again, and that was my last bet, which was April 10th, 1968.
Arnie Wexler, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you. And anytime you need anything, give me a holler.
Arnie Wexler is a compulsive gambling counselor and former executive director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.